From the World Newsroom in Boston, this is Tech Podcast number 124. The World is a joint production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. Jason Margolis here, back in Boston after a week's hiatus up north in Canada. I had a good time up in Canada, but I got caught in a nasty snowstorm on the U.S.-Canadian border. It dumped about 2 feet of snow. Tens of thousands of people lost power, apparently, on both sides of the border, right around Buffalo. Kind of a freak October snowstorm. But I got some good stories up in Ontario, which we'll be rolling out on our program in the next few days. This week on the podcast, however, some cool stories, the challenges of building a new island in the waters off Dubai and restoring an old island in France. A story about the virtual world Second Life. Seems that Second Life is all over the news these days. It was in the Washington Post and New York Times this week. And we'll have a story on the podcast about how the Reuters news agency has opened a virtual news business in Second Life. They're reporting on virtual people in a virtual world. There's also a piece this week on the podcast about restrictions on internet access in Iran. A story about, and pardon my crassness, a story about cow burps and climate change. We begin this week's podcast in Africa with a story about treating malaria. Given how much we tend to hear about the devastating impact of HIV/AIDS in Africa, it's easy to forget that it's actually malaria that kills more children in African countries than any other single disease. Various methods have been tried over the years to control its speed, from the chemical DDT to specially treated mosquito nets. But the holy grail's always been a vaccine. So far, those efforts have failed. But now clinical trials of a new vaccine against malaria have begun in Ghana. The BBC's medical correspondent Fergus Walsh went to Ghana, where he was given exclusive access to the trials.
It was the most unusual start to any assignment I've had for the BBC. This was a ceremony of welcome from an Ashanti chief in Ghana. And it was not just a piece of ritual. Chief Nana Akwaku Sarpong is a former health minister of Ghana and carries considerable influence in the Ogogo region. The doctors running the vaccine trial had sought his personal support before they began recruiting volunteers. After the tribal elders had sprinkled my gift of schnapps on the floor, the ceremony was over. The vaccine trial was blessed, and so, apparently, was my reporting. So then it was on to the health clinic in Ogogo to meet some of the 20 mothers who'd brought their babies along to be immunised. Malaria is the biggest threat to children here. Ernest Agyei is a mischievous and lively 14-month-old boy. His mother Dora explained why she was having him immunised.
I don't want him to become a sick person in my family. Yes, I'll be very happy in life.
Happy for Ernest?
Yes, because I love my son.
More than 500 children in Ghana are taking part in the trials. They'll get 2 or 3 doses of the vaccine. Not the happiest of moments for Ernest, but he may well live to be grateful for receiving the vaccine. The hope is it will train his immune system to recognise and destroy the malaria parasite.
Hello, how are you?
And this was quite a moment for the man who invented the vaccine. Dr. Joe Cohen of GlaxoSmithKline said creating a vaccine against a parasitic infection was highly complex.
I think the main challenge, very briefly, is the complexity of the parasite itself. Parasites are manifold more complex than bacteria or viruses, pathogens for which we have been able to develop vaccine, as you know. Parasites have devised ways of escaping the immune system of the host. that are exquisite. And I think that's the major reason why we haven't been able to, up to now, develop any vaccine against any parasite.
And the vaccine being tested in Ghana is not perfect. An earlier trial in Mozambique showed that it cut cases of malaria by a third and outbreaks of severe malaria by half. So would that level of effectiveness warrant mass immunisation?
Is she eating, sister? Can you ask mother?
A brief visit to the malaria ward at Agogo Hospital provides the answer. Half the children admitted there have malaria. Dr. Jennifer Evans, who's running the trial in Agogo, says even a vaccine that's not completely effective will still save many lives.
A 40% reduction in severe malaria will make a significant impact on childhood mortality in this country. Well over 1 million children a year die in sub-Saharan Africa from severe malaria. So if we're looking at saving even half of those children, that is a significant impact.
The Microsoft billionaire Bill Gates has given $250 million to accelerate the development of a malaria vaccine. Dr. Joe Cohen of GlaxoSmithKline says the partnership between the Gates charity and industry will deliver.
We have both a commitment that this vaccine will be made accessible to the people who need it in Africa. You can imagine that we haven't spent actually more than 20 years at GlaxoSmithKline working on malaria vaccine development to see this vaccine eventually ending up sitting on the shelf and not being used where it is most needed.
But now we must wait, because Ernest and all the other children on the trial must be monitored for many months to see how well they're protected. The target date for the vaccine to be licensed is 2011. It could be the year that the war on malaria begins to be won.
For our next story, let's flip over to the other side of Africa and across the Middle East to Dubai. The Gulf Emirate of Dubai has become known for its incredible rate of development and rapid growth. And some of the land reclamation projects have attracted international interest. Perhaps the most famous is the island created in the shape of a palm tree. That's due to open soon. It's been heralded as an engineering feat. But what has been the impact on the environment? The BBC's Gulf correspondent Julia Wheeler has been finding out, and she files this story.
It seems everywhere you look in Dubai, there's construction. Alongside the beach, in the desert, in the suburbs, it's all around. This city is determined to grow economically, and to do that it needs to build hotels for tourists, office blocks for businesses, and houses for residents. But as environmental analyst Dr. Mohamed Raouf of the Gulf Research Centre explains, development like this comes at a price.
In the last 10 years, there is a big boom in all aspects, in non-oil industries, tourism, construction. It's very fast, all happening at the same time. Always the development have a negative impact.
One of the biggest concerns for environmentalists is land reclamation, like that at the man-made Palm Island in Jumeirah. Palm Island stretches 5 kilometres out into the Gulf and will soon be home to tens of thousands of people. The palm was made by bringing large rocks from different locations, dropping them onto the seabed in the shape of a huge palm tree, and then covering them with sand dredged from the sea floor.
It has been evident in some places with more construction and more reclamation. Many of the marine fish, especially live in the coral reefs, began to disappear. We know that we lose a very valuable marine biodiversity, which is very rare only in some areas with these climatic conditions.
My name is Ibrahim Azabi. I'm the Director of Environment and Research at the Emirates Diving Association. Now it's a construction site in the sea. First of all, it's not safe to be in the water now. One of the things also that changed the beach itself, you know, where we're standing now, it used to be the same level. And I remember 5 years ago, we used to dive the breakwater just behind us. And I used to see clownfish there, anemones. Once I saw a baby guitar shark, cuttlefish, lots of corals there.
Here on the shore, just near the bridge which connects Palm Island to the land, I can see the almost finished apartment buildings lining either side of the trunk in front of me. And off a little bit further into the distance are large villas covering the branches or the fronds of the island. And some of those look very nearly complete. In fact, the first residents are due to move in over the next couple of months. The developer is the government-owned Nakheel, which means palm trees in Arabic. Its environmental manager, Sean Lenehan, says research was done to assess the impact on the ecosystem before the reclamation began.
Before we started any work, we concluded that 95% of the sea floor beneath the footprint of Palm Jumeirah was in fact barren sands and muds. And by building Palm Jumeirah, we've in fact created a diverse array of habitat structures. So as far as the marine ecology goes, it's very positive, it seems.
You say that there was 95% of just mud and sand, but that was the natural environment here, that was the ecosystem. Is it still okay to destroy that?
You're right, it is a change in the habitat type, but I think that previous habitat type is very well represented along the coast of the UAE and across the Gulf.
Campaigners here realise it's unrealistic to expect the environment to remain pristine, but what they would like to see is responsible development. Mohammed Raouf again.
We cannot say we are very late. We have not come to the point of no return, but we need to take right now the required mitigation measures in order to guarantee that the environment itself regenerate.
But Dubai is never a place to do things by halves. Two more palms and hundreds of islands that form the shape of a world map are being reclaimed and built upon just offshore.
All right, that story was about building a new island. This next story is about restoring an old one. France has embarked upon a hydrological experiment in a bid to make the Mont Saint-Michel an island again. That's the most visited tourist spot in provincial France. This pyramid of rock and medieval architecture off the Normandy coast has been silting up with sand for over a century. Something interesting is happening here. While engineers are set about washing millions of tons of sand out to sea, those guiding the projects and the monks who live on the Mont say they are also reaffirming the spiritual character of what is one of Christianity's most ancient places of pilgrimage. An interesting story about technology and spirituality. John Lawrenson of the BBC reports from the Mont Saint-Michel.
Chose sublime, pyramide merveilleuse, mass at the abbey that forms the summit of what the novelist Victor Hugo called this sublime and marvellous pyramid. But most of the time these days, the Mont doesn't rise out of the sea, but from a car park. Sand's been moving in on the Mont Saint-Michel ever since the river Quinon was tamed by a land reclamation project. But now, as if in an act of biblical retribution, engineers are about to send floods to sweep the sands and the tourist buses away.
So here you can see the existing dam. This dam will be destroyed when we will have finished to build.
Project spokeswoman Mathilde Charron, showing me round the engineering works that got underway this summer, says the idea is to restore the tidal power of the river.
We're not going to dig mechanically any sediment out of the bay. This is just useless to do that.
Because there's too much sand.
And the sedimentation would not stop. What we needed to is to recreate a natural downstream movement, a flush, with enough hydraulic power to make the sediments get out of the bay.
As for the coaches and cars, they'll be banished to the continent, as the 30 inhabitants of the Mont Saint-Michel call it. The dike that serves as a road bridge at the moment will be replaced by a car-free jetty. Tourists will walk the last 300 metres to the Mont over an earth platform. And for much of the year, the platform will be underwater, except for a narrow footpath. For the monks, nuns and priests, who make up almost half of the local population, a little clear blue water between the Mont Saint-Michel and the outside world is no bad thing.
Oh, yeah,
Monks sing and say grace before lunch in the medieval abbey at the top of the Mont Saint-Michel.
Sois béni Seigneur pour ce mystère de la Sainte Croix que nous célébrons.
After lunch and washing up, all of which take place in silence, Brother François, a former advertising executive, leads me out into the abbey garden. The view across the bay is splendid, the view of the car park less so.
Toutes ces voitures garées, tous ces autocars, ce bruit, c'est...
All those parked cars and coaches, all that noise are a stain on Mont Saint-Michel. But making the Mont an island again isn't just about aesthetics. For the pilgrims who come here across the bay, they're crossing the desert and braving the tides that part like the Red Sea to let them through to the promised land. And for tourists, just having to get out of their cars and walk those last few hundred meters will create a break between the land, the world of earthly considerations, if you like, and this mystical place, this celestial Jerusalem, seen from afar, seems to float in the sky.
The best way to see what Brother François means is to take off your socks and shoes and walk to the Mont Saint-Michel across the bay at low tide, wading through the rivers, struggling out of the quicksand, getting soaked to the bone and catching your death. Pilgrims have long known that easier does not mean better, and that philosophy is shared by the project director, François-Xavier de Boulaincourt.
Ce projet, c'est la lutte des siècles. Ce projet...
Up to now, monuments like Mont Saint-Michel have always had to bend to the will of the economy, the demand for more agricultural land in the 19th century, the demands of tourism in the 20th. Each year, for example, we'd enlarge the car park to accommodate more cars and buses. But in the 21st century, we're turning that logic around. Now it's the tourists who are going to adapt to Mont Saint-Michel.
Not that that's necessarily bad for business, with the tourists crammed into Mont Saint-Michel's tiny streets.
In this way, they could preserve Mont Saint-Michel from car and from noisy tourists. I think this could be better for the place.
And it's not just that many tourists, like this visitor from Spain, won't mind the inconvenience. Many others will come especially to see the Mont Saint-Michel surrounded by sea. Once the work is completed in 2012, the Mont will return to how it was in centuries past, with one major difference, the tourists. And, adds Monsieur de Boulaincourt, as if it were by the by, not the 3 million a year there are now, but 5 million.
For the next story, we turn our attention back to the Middle East. The government of Iran announced this week that it has plans to ban high-speed internet access in its country. It's the latest in a string of restrictions of access to information. In recent months, police in Iran have seized thousands of satellite dishes. In September, the government shut down Iran's most prominent reformist newspaper because it refused to remove an executive accused of publishing what the government calls blasphemous articles insulting officials. Here's a story I did this week for our radio program. It's estimated that 5 million people in Iran access the internet regularly. The majority are young and computer savvy. The Iranian government already blocks many websites like political blogs, foreign news, online gambling, and pornography. Today, the government said internet service providers in Iran won't be able to deliver the internet at speeds faster than 128 kilobytes per second. That's faster than dial-up, but significantly slower than being on a broadband network. The new rule won't prevent people from accessing sites. It'll just slow them down. The government didn't say why they were doing this. Still, Mehrdad Faramond, who is a producer with the BBC's Persian service, says today's announcement has a clear purpose.
I think this has to do with censorship, because they already filter some websites. And, you know, in filtering, they use softwares which are sensitive to particular words. But they cannot do that with video. And by restricting the speed, they actually want to prevent videos to be downloaded.
In the past, Iranian officials have blamed foreign music, films, and television programs for undermining Islamic culture. The web is often hailed as the force that can bring about democracy and open dialogue in countries like Iran. But Farahman says the vast majority of young Iranians use the web for the same reason young people here do, to flirt.
In a country which is not both legally and socially acceptable to directly go to girls and find a girlfriend, now the most convenient way to find a girlfriend for an Iranian guy is just going to chat rooms, and vice versa for the Iranian girls as well.
The politically active in Iran do rely on the internet as a broader source for news. Despite the censors, many people are finding ways to get through to block sites and essentially reopen the internet. Nart Vilnev is with the University of Toronto's Citizen Lab.
The basic principle is, since you can't access a website directly because it's being blocked, you access the website through another computer.
So, for example, if somebody in Iran or China wanted to freely browse the web, they could log on to a server in Seattle or St. Louis. The problem is that once this trick is discovered, the censoring government can block that access as well. But Vilnev's lab is testing a new software that turns home computers into servers. In a game of cat and mouse, this could put the engineers a step ahead.
What we decided to build was software that was incredibly easy to use, that people on their normal home computers in uncensored countries could install. But the distribution mechanism isn't public, so you only give out the address to people that you know and trust.
Besides technological fixes, some young Iranians are looking for political ways to make their voices heard. More than 1,000 people signed a petition today addressed to Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. They called today's ban on high-speed internet access backward and unprincipled. Our next story is about, and excuse my crudeness once again, is about cow burps. Scientists in the United Kingdom are suggesting a new approach to tackling climate change. They say more should be done to encourage farmers to reduce methane emissions from cattle. The gas produced by cows, sheep, and goats when they belch is more than 20 times more harmful as a greenhouse gas than CO2, carbon dioxide. Agriculture produces almost half of the UK's methane. As the BBC's Angus Crawford reports, scientists are working hard to find a solution.
This is number 128. She's a beautiful Jersey cow, surrounded by all of her sisters. She's got big brown eyes and she's chewing away in front of me. But as she's chewing, she's also gently belching. And as she does that, she produces methane gas. In fact, she could be producing as much as 500 litres a day. Methane is actually 23 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than CO2.
We could easily say that dairy cows in this country are producing something like 270, 280 kilotons of methane per year.
As Professor David Beaver points out, cattle produce about 3% of the UK's emissions of gases which cause global warming. Reducing that would make farming both more efficient and greener.
Cows don't ruminate. Nothing more soporific than to see cows ruminating, chewing their cud, looking contented. And that's not been happening.
He used to be an academic and now works for feed producer Richard Keenan and Company. The problem with modern cows, he says, they're not doing what they're designed to, chew. One simple solution, chewier feed.
Instead of milk having a burden of perhaps 35 litres of methane per litre of milk, we could be talking about something as low as 25 or even 20.
So a 25% potential reduction in methane?
Absolutely.
On working farms and in labs around the world, scientists are trying out other ideas. Inoculations, microbes, and at the University of Wales in Aberystwyth, Professor Jamie Newbold is experimenting with garlic.
This extract from garlic can significantly reduce methane production from cattle and sheep. And what we're trying to do at the moment is to find the active ingredient in garlic and isolate that from, possibly the smelly aspects of garlic.
Methane is actually a very short-lived gas in the atmosphere, so if we can reduce our methane emissions now, then it will have disappeared from our atmosphere by around about 2030.
Surrounded by the noise and the fumes of a busy road in the centre of Oxford, Dr. Christian Jardine from the university's Environmental Change Institute.
What that also means is that it will allow us to buy time for technologies to come in place to reduce our carbon dioxide emissions. So it buys time for renewables to become cheaper.
So it's actually a very good target gas. Do you think the government's doing enough to target it at the moment?
Well, the government doesn't really have any direct policies targeting methane emissions, and we think that were these to be introduced, that we would see continued reductions in methane emissions that could be sustained in the long term.
But the solutions themselves are not without cost.
If you have a feed additive that reduces methane emissions that has to be produced on the other side of the world and shipped across in large amounts by the burning of fossil fuels, and you're generating more carbon dioxide in greenhouse gas potency terms than the methane you're cutting back, that wouldn't be a very compelling argument.
Professor Chris Pollock is an agriculturalist. He's also advised the British government about research funding into sustainability. Scientists, farmers and politicians, he believes, have got to look at the problem in a new and holistic way.
Joining up is all. You need to be able to have a common currency that allows scientists to look at benefits in one area and compare them with disbenefits in the other.
And our last story for the podcast is about the virtual online world Second Life. To be part of Second Life, users download software that gives them access to the Second Life computers, which then send back real-time video of the goings-on in the virtual world. Users can buy their own space, their own property, with real-world money. And so far, nearly a million people have done that. Now the global news agency Reuters has opened its own virtual news business in Second Life. Here's an interesting interview done by the BBC with Adam Pasek. Mr. Pasek will serve as the new Reuters Second Life bureau chief.
Second Life is a 3D virtual world. You sign on and you receive something called an avatar, which can look like anything you want. It can be tall or short, or it can be a robot or a stuffed animal if you prefer. Once you're in there, you can do all sorts of things. You can open your own business. You can create things out of thin air, things like houses or T-shirts or helicopters. And you can meet quite a few interesting people.
And the avatar is the new you.
Exactly.
And I've seen a picture of your new you, and it does look rather like you. Why would you want to, on behalf of your employer, Reuters, be in this virtual world?
Reuters is going into Second Life as a way of engaging with a new group of readers, and because we think there's something quite exciting going on, and we think we can learn something by going in. We're also bringing quite a bit of real-world news that Reuters writes into Second Life, so if people want to read about politics or entertainment or technology, they can do that, and we've created a special discussion area where they can get together and talk about the news of the day.
But there are also going to be reports of the virtual activities of the virtual people in the virtual world.
Exactly. That's what I'll be doing. And there are a lot of virtuals and the like, but there's a very real economy going on because Second Life has its own currency, which can be exchanged into dollars. And so people are running real businesses in a virtual world and making real profits, some of them quite a lot.
Who's the most successful? Do we know?
The most successful is a woman named Anchi Chung. She's a virtual real estate developer, very modern title. And by most accounts, she's earning several hundred thousand U.S. dollars a year by buying property and developing into these kind of themed communities like a subdivision for German speakers or Japanese speakers. And she's been quite successful at it.
Presumably this is not just people with too much money throwing it away. They're getting something out of it, those who pay her for the right to set up the properties.
Right. They get a virtual house out of it, quite cool ones, where they can hang out with their friends. The real part comes when she takes her profits in Second Life, if she chooses to do so, and she converts them into U.S. dollars.
It's a marketing enterprise.
Not at all. It's a new market that Reuters is covering. It's just like if we were opening a bureau in a new economy somewhere. Second Life's economy is growing at 20% a month. And there's some very fascinating things going on, especially where the real world crosses over into the virtual one. For example, one of the stories that I've written today for our launch is that there's a U.S. congressional committee that has launched an investigation into whether they should be taxing virtual economies like Second Life.
What's it like working in that virtual world? How all-encompassing is it?
For me, it seems very strange at first. There's a bit of a learning curve. But after a while, I've come to realize that it's really not all that different for than being a reporter in the real world. You go out and you talk to interesting people. You read as much as you can. You chase up interesting stories and you confirm them. So it works surprisingly well in a virtual world.
And that's going to do it for this week's podcast. Thanks very much for listening. See you again in a week. Thank you.